there. Thanks for joining me. You're listening to Drinking from the Toilet, and I'm Hannah Brannigan. This week, I had a rare chance to hang out with my training buddy and reluctant podcast guest, Shade Weitzel. We don't get to hang out as often as I'd like because, well, mostly because she lives on the complete other side of the country from where I live, so our paths don't cross in real life as often as I wish that they did, because she's one of my favorite people to train with. We do so many things alike, even though we have completely different dogs and we train completely different sports. The way we approach problems, there's a lot in common, but also enough different that I always learn something and I always get good feedback and a different point of view just from that experience of spending time with a really high-level trainer who is able to speak my language. So it's one of my favorite things to do when we hang out. And you may remember Shade from episode, I believe it's number 7, where we talked about a few other things. And this time we were hanging out training dogs, and after a beer or so, I was able to convince her to hop on a podcast with me. So this one was pretty informal. We just recorded it using my phone. So you'll notice the audio is not as amazing as usual, but it's also not terrible. And I think it was really interesting. We talked about this idea that I first heard of from her, which is the term force light, in sort of air quotes there. And well, I'll let her tell you what it means to her, and we'll talk about a couple of different examples and in real life and kind of explore it. This is one of those things where there's no right or wrong answer, but I think for a lot of us that have are continuing our journey in trying to be more positive and more clearly with our training and with our interactions with people, these are scenarios that I think maybe will resonate with a few people. I hope that they do. I hope it's not just me. But anyways, here it is in all of its awkward and random ramblingness. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, so see, if it helps at all, I'm just as awkward.
Yeah.
When we're trying to record these things as you are, if not more so.
Right. Now it's your responsibility.
And now it's my responsibility to podcast like some kind of professional-ish person.
So we can fake it well.
We can fake it.
Yes.
So
let's talk about force light.
So I'm interested because you are the one who first used this term. And I liked it because as soon as you said it, I visualized a can of Diet Right soda that said force light on it. And as we're drinking it, and I'm hearing is it David Allan Coe song in my head, Merry Christmas from the Family. And then I'm replacing Diet Right with Force Light in my head. So I love that visual because I, obviously, as part of my adult ADHD, like to ping pong around random visualizations that are completely unrelated. So it's
right.
Sort of an art form. I think I could probably, if I had visual art abilities, I could probably produce some really trippy paintings.
That would sell for tons of money.
Tons of money.
Right.
Yeah. So we usually end up talking about force light when we're not being our best versions of ourselves when we're training.
Right.
Or we're cutting a corner in some way that maybe we wouldn't have recognized 10 years ago, but often catch ourselves making a choice now that we maybe wish we weren't making.
I've got all sorts of things running through my head, which is why I'm like not saying anything.
It's not just that you don't like me.
I like you just fine. I coined the term. I don't think I coined it. I probably heard it from somebody. But I think of force light as when we're – it's not so much correction. I don't know.
I think for me when – and I don't want to put words into your mouth because I'm using this as a word after – hearing you use it, but I think recognizing a space where I go that is not, it's not necessarily punishment, but neither is it my best clickerly training. It's usually I'm in a little bit of a hurry and I want a thing and I could wait for the dog to fully choose what it is that I want, but instead I reduce the choices. So I think let's start with a concrete example. So I think one we both see a lot is I'm playing tug with my dog. I want to do the next rep and I give him the cue to out, to drop the toy, and he doesn't drop the toy right away. And I'm not bringing a lot. I mean, I'm not actively punishing from a point of intent, but I will bring my hands closer together on the toy
right
on either side of his mouth, which probably work. I mean, it works some of the time.
Him to drop it.
It makes I think it puts a little bit of a negative reinforcement contingency on letting go of the toy. It makes right. It certainly makes continuing to hold the toy a little less pleasant than it had been.
Yeah. So that's a really good example because most of the time that's exactly what I see with the toy play. And I will even go so far as to say a lot of times our obedience can be forced light. So even our drop it.
Yeah.
As we're coercing might be the word that I'm looking for. We could wait for the, so as I go further in my training, what I really want the dog to do is drop the toy to re-engage in work. I want that choice and I want that knowledge as a trainer from the dog. When I say drop it and I make the dog drop it, either by showing them a piece of food or kind of moving my hands in a way that makes them more to drop it or something like that, then sometimes I feel, I'm sure there's exceptions, but I do feel like the dog isn't necessarily choosing to drop it. They may need a moment, mm-hmm. and I'm not giving them that moment. And the reason that I don't want to do this in my training is because I want total buy-in from my dog.
Sure.
And when I don't get it, there's something that I should be paying attention to.
Right, yeah. And I think, you know, what I see, I hadn't thought about it, but I think you're right when you're saying, like, with the drop it a little louder, drop it with the mean voice. Like, we're escalating the cue, and we'll do the same thing with down, lie down.
Right.
And even if we never go any further than that, even if, I think any time we're in a situation where we've given a cue for any behavior probably, and we have a non-response or we don't get the behavior, and then we escalate the cue in some way, either by leaning into the dog or closing our hands up on the toy or giving the cue in a louder voice, we maybe are starting to edge into that place where it's certainly not good training anymore.
Right.
Because even if he does drop it, once I've said drop it the third time and now I'm yelling, well, at best, my cue has now become drop it instead of drop it.
Right, exactly.
So I'm changing the cue there, and I think I'm almost certainly bringing, again, there's a little bit.
I think that there's a little bit of or else.
Right, exactly.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so I am, it's not that I'm against it. It's that I think we need to be aware of it.
Right.
We need to be aware of the little subtle ways that as positive trainers, we're still using or else.
Yeah.
And that's my technical definition of force light, is that we're sort of coercing, or we're sort of saying we're escalating our voices, or we're weight shifting towards the dog, or we're using obedience to get the dog to do something that they wouldn't want to do. And the reason that I think I concentrate on it less now, but the reason that I was really aware of it before is that if the dog perceives it as a correction, and when you get highly motivated dogs, then you might have to escalate that correction. And so it's really important that you understand when you're using something that might be perceived that way with the dog. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
actually. Am I explaining it okay?
Well,
that's probably why I started really noticing those little subtle things that we do.
Yeah, I think there's a slippery slope aspect there, right? Like if I start, and there's the, and on the flip side of it, there's that effect again, slippery slope. It's very subtle, but punishment being reinforcing to the punisher. If I say drop it and it works,
right,
I'm very likely to do that again the next time I'm not getting the toy back fast enough.
Yep.
And I'm not, obviously I don't do this in real life.
Never.
I never get impatient and just want the damn toy back.
You're never just human.
But when like that happens, and even if I'm not consciously doing it, I'm likely to repeat that behavior the next time.
Right.
And then if the next time
reward
history for me. And then if the next time drop it doesn't work, I'm probably going to go to drop it.
Right.
So I'll
with
a step forward, and I'll start to creep further down that line.
Right.
Then I might want, and I suspect it's something that can happen kind of subtly. And then, you know, eventually, hopefully I'll notice, oh, you know what? You're not being the trainer that you want to be. Maybe we should put the dog up.
Right.
Maybe we need to reevaluate the situation, but it starts way before. Like, I'm recognizing that starts way before where I would have recognized it before.
Yes.
And then I think there's also,
so one of the reasons that I really started noticing this is because if you build that type of relationship with your dog from day one, is that you're just subtly correcting. Let's just call it correcting. We should probably define that word better, but you're subtly saying it. With the more motivated dogs that want something very much, you're going to have to escalate that.
They'll develop a punishment callus just like they would.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this normally happens with dogs that I encounter in the sport that I do, is that people don't think they're correcting, but they are. And then it leads to the myth that the strong dogs, what am I saying? It leads to the myth that,
strong dogs can't be trained with positive reinforcement.
Right. Because they're still subtly correcting, give me the toy or else weight shift, or this dog just needs verbal correction.
Right.
And, you know, and so I do want to make it clear that this might sound kind of harsh, but I don't really care if we're correcting or not from like whether or not we should use corrections in the sport or whether
we should. It's not a moral question.
Right. It's not a moral question at all. But I want us to be aware of how the dog perceives it, because if you want to have a dog like that that you're going to raise with no correction, then you should be aware when you are. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Am I making?
Yeah. No, I think, I think for me, where it is really kind of gelling a little bit is when you added that or else, because
mm-hmm.
that's one of my concerns or complaints or soapboxes when we start talking about release cues with any duration behavior or stay behavior or an agility behavior, where we're okay is a release cue, because not that there's anything wrong with changing to a different behavior, like getting up from the sit. That's a behavior. That's a movement. So it's
right.
a behavior.
Right.
But when we start using the term release cue, I often hear the implied or else, and I'm talking about myself as much as anyone else,
right.
like, because then there's the, well, what if he hadn't been released?
Right.
And then there's the, well, then he hasn't been released yet. What are we going to do about it?
Right.
And if that starts to lead us, I think it's a mind space problem where when I'm, using force light or an implied or else, it's almost always, regardless of my intent, I am still in a stopping behavior mindset rather than a building behavior mindset.
Yes. Yes. And then it leads to the training stuff that I would wish that I'm better at. So I don't, if I'm going to say drop it, drop it, drop it, going back to our original thing of, you know, drop the toy now so I can do another rep of healing, then where was I going with this? If I lost my train of thought.
It's totally. Okay, because, you know, we can edit all of this.
Totally.
Totally edit it out.
Nice if you edit it.
Yeah. Do I do it all the time? So when we're, I think, you know, again, when I, you know, I'm escalating a cue, I'm stopping some behavior. There's an effective punisher involved, no matter. And I think that's where I worry about these types of training choices, because this is really what we're talking about. We're talking about like human behavior training choices,
right?
Totally outside of a moral,
right?
A moral issue. There's if one assumes that any stimuli falls somewhere on a continuum, right? It's not black and white. It's not that a steak versus a baseball bat. Right.
Right.
There's a long continuum.
Right.
And then it kind of circles back around to, we're stopping a behavior. So if we're stopping a behavior with whatever we're doing, whatever stimulus we're bringing, a slightly louder voice, an eyebrow, that is a punisher.
Right.
Right? Whether we're intending it, and no matter how non-physically damaging, or even overtly emotionally damaging, I think, because I can certainly put, if I'm trying to get Gambit to let go of a toy and I'm putting my hands on either side of it, his facial expression does not change
right. In
an obvious way.
Right.
So I could easily justify that, and I have to myself frequently, but he's fine. It's not hurting anything. He's not, this is still fine. But at the same time, I am changing something about the environment that's stopping his behavior of continuing to hold onto the toy.
Right.
And then that small amount of pressure, which is, I think at worst a discomfort for him in this particular scenario, and maybe even not that far, but I have crossed that kind of midline from I'm building the behavior of drop the toy, and to now I am putting more training energy, or I'm shifting a little bit of the focus onto stopping the undesired behavior rather than on starting or building the desired behavior.
Right.
And that changes.
It changes the for me, and I can only speak for myself. It changes. So I'm always about, I don't know if it's scientific enough, but I'm always about the why. Like, why did the dog that previously dropped the toy now won't drop the toy on the first cue, or whether it's physical signal or a verbal signal, and I have to do something further to get the dog to drop the toy? Why is that? And what is the dog telling me that?
What changed?
What changed? And why is the dog now not motivated to drop the toy when I've spent the dog's whole life trying to get them really motivated to drop the toy? So when I see that, I would rather, as the dog's teacher, I would rather try to figure out what made the dog not drop it. Does
sure.
that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
is dropping the toy, like, is the reinforcement that's been in place for dropping
right.
the toy no longer as valuable?
It's no longer there.
So is there a motivating operation that
right.
is gumming up the works?
So when I tend to use force light, so I'll make the dog drop the toy, whether verbal or physical. I'll take it from their mouth and they'll let it. And it's not like they're traumatized or anything, but they're just like, but what happens is that I'm usually, there's usually something else that's going slightly wrong in the training plan
yeah.
that I should pay attention to.
Right.
And
usually there's been some lumping.
There's been some lumping, or the environment is ever facing, my current dog. Or something that I really should have paid attention to. And so that's kind of where I'm at now in my training, is trying to really figure out why the dog didn't do that, or what I can, not so much why, but what I can do to motivate the dog to then better drop the toy.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, I think it does, because it's like, it's the temptation that we stick with the training plan we had before we get the dog out, or we listen to the dialogue that the dog
exactly
doesn't. Well, it turns out that scent discrimination is not what the dog needs to work on today.
Right.
Today we need to work on coming in and out of the crate.
Exactly. Around another dog. So, yeah, so it's, so I find that when I don't listen to that, and when I do what I call force light, make the dog do it, then it blows up in my face later. It might be 3 sessions later. It might be the next time, it might be in the case of my oldest dog, it was basically, months and years later, where he was finally like, I've had enough. Mm-hmm. Stop telling me to drop that toy. I don't really want to drop the toy. You've never given me my moment that I need right here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take it. I'm 8 years old. I'm taking my moment. So when I talk about Force Light, I talk about like a little bit of the or else. It's usually my non-technical general definition of ways we coerce the dog. Coerce, maybe, mm-hmm. is that a word I want to use? Ways we don't listen to the dog?
Yeah.
And usually it involves like getting toys away from them. Or getting them in situations.
I think maybe there's what we're kind of circling around is the situations where there's conflicting motivators involved, where the dog's motivation to do one thing is maybe a little bit higher than would be convenient.
Mm-hmm.
whether it's a motivation to avoid getting in the bathtub or
just went through my head and then out again.
So like if I'm trying to a non-toy example that I have caught myself obviously before, because I wouldn't do anything like this, but have caught myself doing is maybe I'm trying to get a certain young man into a crate and he's maybe not ready to go in the crate yet.
Right.
And he gets a treat for going in the crate. He'll get a bully stick in this imaginary scenario that is not real. And so there's a positive reinforcement contingency that go in the crate, the bully stick becomes available.
Right.
But in this moment, the availability of the bully stick for going in the crate is warring with continuing to do other less socially acceptable behaviors outside of the crate. And so there's that conflicting motivation. And so the temptation for some other trainer, not me, might be
never me,
to put my hand in his collar.
Right.
And just, even push the dog, but just hold the collar in such a way that there's just the little, I'm adding the carrot of the bully stick with just a little bit of stick.
Right.
To try and make the balance sheet,
right.
you know, come right. out in favor of getting in the crate. And I think, and of course that now we're starting to mix those. And so, you know, the idea is, well, if I add, you know, bully stick on one side of the scale, plus a little bit of collar pressure,
right.
like that should help tip the balance and make less acceptable behaviors, which have been occurring outside of the crate, less appealing, relatively speaking, then I might get the crate behavior and then I would consider it okay because he did get the bully stick.
Right,
so,
exactly.
So it's okay because he got the bully stick in the end. But the next time I go to put him in a crate in a similar context, he might pause and I might reach for his collar and he might duck.
Right. He might duck away. Exactly. So why is this important? Why do we care? Because like forcing the dog into a crate, what's wrong with it? You know,
and it's
example.
Not even really force.
Right.
I mean, it's finger of pressure.
Right. Exactly. So as trainers, why do we care about this?
So I think one of the things that I would care the most about for my own training is, am I lying to myself about
right.
why the dog's actually doing it? Is he going in the crate because this is a positive association, or am I gradually and subtly eroding the conditioned emotional response that he has for going in his crate by introducing just, am I opening the door for a poisoned cue
yep.
down the road?
Yep. Or are you also kind of back to that slippery slope that you were talking about? When the dog ducks and then you grab his collar, then suddenly it's not one finger of pressure.
Right.
So you have to escalate the pressure.
And if he's fast, I might even have to do a little bit of a scoop.
Right. You might have to grab quickly. So concern is the wrong word. Because I'm not sure that I'm, like, concerned about that
It's just a mindfulness thing.
It's just I notice that. And I want to notice and I want to be aware that if the dog didn't go, like in your example, if the dog didn't go into the crate, then and I had to use, you know, just a little bit of collar pressure to get him to go, then that should tell me something that I might need to do 20 reps of going into your crate.
In and out
to make more of a reward history. That would just tell me that I need to put a little more, I need to be mindful of it, and I need to put positive reinforcement on that particular thing.
We need to pull that behavior out, take a look at it. Is it,
exactly.
Do I need to reinforce going in the crate more?
Right.
Maybe it's because he has already developed some negative association with the crate. The crate has already been poisoned in and of itself, and I'm now seeing that fallout.
Right.
For some unrelated thing. Maybe he was in the crate and some loud noise happened. I don't know. Now I'm making
and
this
now
up,
but he's a little bit weird about going in the crate.
Right.
Exactly.
And I'm ignoring that and hoping that if I just make not going in the crate a little less pleasant, then he'll choose going in the crate.
Right.
And it'll just make it all sweep it under the rug.
But which it might for some dogs.
It might. Because, well, there's a little bit of an unpredictability there.
Right.
But it also, of course, then continues to reinforce me for just adding a little bit,
right.
a little bit of something. And then I think also it's important, I think you were saying, because this isn't necessarily a moral issue.
No.
Because if there was a tornado, I would absolutely take his collar.
Sure.
I'd throw him in the back
exactly.
of the crate, right? Like this, if it's
totally.
And that's not a training moment
right.
at that point. But it's if I want to be honest with myself
right.
and be aware of all of the variables that are going into this equation, I need to recognize when I make those little choices and not think that they're not happening. Or even, I think worse, you know, 5 years ago, I wouldn't have even noticed. It wouldn't
right.
have. I would have been completely mystified if 2 weeks after that incident, he's now avoiding me when I walk near the crate.
Right. Exactly. Let me give another example, toy related as usual, because I teach the toy, so I see all this stuff.
Adult toy classes.
Yes. Adult toy classes. For dogs. Handler is trying to do, I get the dog to within a 2-ball game. So dog chases one ball, and now I want them to get the ball in the owner's hand. So normally the first step would be we'll show him that we've got another ball, and the dog would normally drop it. And then you'll throw that second ball. Well, a very common occurrence is that the dog drops the ball they have, and it bounces, so they re-grab it. Instead of focusing their attention on the toy that the owner has, they focus their attention immediately at the one they just dropped. And then the re-grabbing behavior is then reinforced. And so then sometimes you'll get dogs who will drop it and re-grab, drop it and re-grab, drop it and re-grab. Or they'll drop it and try to get both in their mouth. Mm. So the owner will like whatever. So a common thing that people want to do is stick their foot on the ball.
Yes.
So that the dog can't get the ball that they just dropped. So they want to stick their foot on the ball. And so is that management or foresight? Because we're managing the dog's access to the ball.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Of course, it depends a little bit on outcome.
And I don't have a right or wrong answer here.
No.
So
I mean,
I'm not like trying to trick anybody or whatever. I'm just...
No, I mean, I think that's because one could also.
I think it's management if it works quickly. And if you build a different behavior chain of focus on the ball that I have, and you're stepping on the ball to prevent the ball from like rolling and attracting the dog, then I think it's management.
Yeah.
And it can work very well to getting a change in the pattern. If a dog has an established pattern of drop the ball and re-grab it or whatever. Okay, so I think that if that opportunity doesn't present itself by your foot over the ball, it can train another pattern, provided you're training another pattern of focus on the mm-hmm. ball or toy in my hand.
Sure, so you're blocking the access to one reinforcer and providing an opportunity for a different reinforcer.
Exactly. That hopefully is more exciting because it's moving and I'm going to mm-hmm. throw it. So that should be more exciting, chasing this one than re-grabbing and possessing the other one.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is really interesting because management and force light are in many ways the same thing.
Yes.
And it, I think it may be, I don't know, because you're right. It, and I guess it just, I guess it, it's all, it's a little bit what you call it.
Yep.
And how you
so
treat
semantics
it.
Semantics here.
Semantics.
Okay. And, you don't really need to label it anything.
And being aware of the choice, you're choosing to manage the ball, you're choosing to block access to that reinforcement. And then if we were to do nothing else, management, usually we would see no change in behavior, right?
Usually
if you remove the management, the behavior would still be there because we've just blocked access to it, not actually changed the behavior.
Right. So what I would say to that is we might use management blocking access to the ball that was dropped with our foot if we have to. If we don't have to, I don't want to go there. But let's say we've got an established pattern and we want to retrain another pattern. At some point, you have to stop putting your foot over the ball. And the dog has to choose to go for the reinforcement that you have spent the last week training, which is go for the ball in my hand.
And you provide them an option, which is the point of management.
You make the
desired choice very, very easy and reinforce that over and over and over again. And then open the gate a little bit to more variety of choices and hope that the dog continues to make the one that we want.
Right. So it becomes forced light when 6 months later, or it becomes, it's just the same as management. You're just not training.
You haven't actually trained a behavior.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, there's not, no sustained behavior change has occurred, so learning has not actually
happened.
You take
your foot off, the dog's like, yes, like
right
the chew in my mouth.
Yeah, well, so then to flip that around a little bit, let's say we accept the premise that this forced light thing is a slippery slope, you know, down the same road that ends in much harsher aversives. Where do we draw the line when we're telling ourselves that something is management? I mean, I can manage a dog on a buckle collar and I could manage a dog on a different collar choice and still call it management, and it may have very different emotional outcomes.
I think that's something to think about in your training. And I don't think that there's black and white answers to every single situation. But I think these are the questions that we need to think about. It's good to think about stuff like that. It's like, am I managing or am I applying something? Am I adding something?
Are we looking to just block a particular behavior?
Right.
And if so, is the way, the choice that I'm making, how I'm actually blocking it, is this the least invasive, most emotionally safe way that I could block that behavior, block that reinforcement from being achieved, which is sort of how I define management, right? If I put a baby gate up, that's management. It's not actually teaching the dog not to knock the baby over and take the Cheerios. It's just preventing access.
Right.
But that's a pretty benign one, right? Like the baby gate has no active role.
Right.
If I tether that dog and put him on a leash, though, maybe it's neutral, but maybe he also hits the end of that leash a couple of times. Which now maybe we're getting into a punishment, extinction, frustration kind of place.
And depending on the individual dog, they might get more frustrated. You might build frustration and vocalization, in which case now you're not managing. Now you're training a conditioned emotional response. See, I can just go everywhere.
Yeah.
You can't rein me in. I'm like, okay, now I'm thinking worst case scenario. Working line shepherd tethered around the baby.
it's just bait at that point.
Let's just create a hold and bark on the high chair.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, but I mean, and that's continues to underline how difficult it is to really slice all of these processes out, because they're always occurring. Like, we are intending management, but at the same time, we're also potentially putting an extinction procedure in place.
Right.
We may also be putting in a positive punisher if the dog's hitting the end of that tether, even though no one's holding the tether.
Right.
From a behavioral standpoint, we may still see, we're almost certainly in with the nuance that you've added to our example, we're almost certainly going to see extinction as a function of frustration, and then the emotional responses that would be associated with that.
Right.
Which could then also become associated through classical conditioning with the cues, the antecedents that are present in that environment. And you could certainly create a dog that starts vocalizing as soon as you pick up the snap of the tether.
Totally.
Or start walking towards the kitchen.
Right. Right. Yeah. So much to think about. Just, I like to be mindful of how the dog perceives stuff, and we're not going to make decisions that are absolutely perfect. Maybe this is the things that we need to think about. We're never going to make perfect decisions teaching our dogs in competition or in life all the time.
Yeah.
So it's just mindful to look at management techniques. Is it truly management? Do I need to teach another behavior? What is the dog thinking? Why has the behavior changed? Why has their motivation changed? And so it's just important, I think, to really keep in mind that so we can make different choices in the future.
Yeah,
I think
just periodically take a step back.
Check it.
Yeah, just take a step back and you know, try to look objectively. What am I doing right now? What's going on right now?
Right. I still have to put my foot on the ball 6 months later?
And we may still make the same choice, but we're making that
good
choice
enough.
In full awareness. Like, this
right.
is, I can live with this,
right.
and I don't actually, management here is fine. Or, you know, the what I'm gaining from using this, applying a little bit of a negative reinforcement in this scenario is worth what I'm gaining in terms of safety, which there is a little bit of
right.
a moral flavor to that question. Cause, you know, you have to decide what you're comfortable with and what trade-offs. But I think you're being aware of the trade-off is the most important thing. And then you're making a conscious choice to do that instead of just kind of blindly reacting.
Right. Right.
Cool.
Yeah. Definitely.
Thanks for listening. To find the show notes for this episode and to find even more helpful articles and training tips, head over to my website, wonderpupstraining.com. You can even grab a free PDF template to help you plan your training sessions and stay organized. Until next time, I'm Hannah Branigan. Happy training. Cheers.